This is Educate, a podcast from APM Reports about ideas and research on how we teach and learn. I'm Suzanne Pico, in for Stephen Smith. 2 weeks ago on the podcast, we ran a documentary about a year in the life of a class of fourth graders in Chicago. If you missed that, we suggest you stop now and go back to listen, because this week we're going to hear from the producer of that documentary. Linda Lutton has been covering education for more than a decade. As a reporter at WBEZ in Chicago, she's documented all kinds of attempts to fix schools, from changing curriculum to changing teaching strategies to totally restaffing schools and even closing them down. These reform efforts always seem to be focused on the schools in the poorest neighborhoods.
And that made me want to look more closely and specifically at the intersection of poverty and school achievement. And as I say in the piece, really dig into this mystery of why schools in poor communities so consistently fail to do what we ask of them.
A few years ago, in 2014, Linda got a fellowship from the Spencer Foundation. A note of disclosure here, Spencer also funds our education coverage. Now, this fellowship allowed her to spend a year at Columbia University and develop a big reporting project. So she decided to take on this question of poverty and school achievement. Just why is it that so many poor schools are failing? And are any of the reforms working? Our correspondent Emily Hanford sat down with Linda to find out what she learned over the course of reporting her story about the fourth graders in Chicago. It's called The View from Room 205. And again, if you haven't listened yet, scroll back to the podcast 2 weeks ago, check it out, and then come back. We think you'll get a lot more out of this conversation if you've already heard the piece, and it's a great story. Here's Linda and Emily.
Hey, Emily.
Hey. So I want to start at the beginning.
Why fourth grade?
Yeah, why fourth grade?
When you look at a topic like poverty that's been written about for decades, I think Americans come to that topic with a lot of opinions already and a lot of judgments. And I think we are pretty quick to determine that poor people are poor because of their own failings or decisions they've made. I think there's a switch that flips pretty quickly. I think we're willing a lot of times to look at even high school students as being partially responsible for the situation in which they live. You know, those are teenagers. They make decisions about whether they're going to do their homework or not do their homework, what have you. And I intentionally wanted to feature kids who were young enough that Americans could open their minds more to the situation in which they were living. You know, fourth graders they're responsible for making very little of their world. And that's the age I wanted to look at.
The documentary, this radio documentary, is framed really nicely at the beginning. You say right off the bat that we're about to hear a story about little kids and a big idea. And so this big idea is, no matter where you're from or how poor you are, you can make it. And school is where that happens. And this is what we tell kids, as you say in the piece, this is what we tell ourselves. And then as your documentary goes on, you say to us, here's the problem. We just have not made a world for them where this is really true, where it's really true that no matter where you are from or how poor you are, you can make it. Can you tell us, given all of the education reporting you've been doing for so many years and all of the schools that you've visited in neighborhoods in Chicago and the suburbs of Chicago, what really surprised you most about the world that the students at this elementary school on the west side of Chicago, William Penn Elementary School, what surprised you the most about them? You know, those oh my God kind of moments, those moments where you observed this is what these kids are really up against.
I guess at some level I was surprised, and I guess I did not anticipate the severity of certain conditions, like hunger, for instance. There's a scene in the piece where I'm talking to two little boys, one of them in the fourth grade, one of them his brother. I'm talking to them just outside. They've been to the playground, or they're headed to the playground, and they're really hungry, and they're saying that in little kid ways that are really painful to hear. But I'd say that isn't the only moment in which I witnessed hungry kids and hungry families. That becomes very hard to report and repeatedly see. So that was one thing. I think also the, you know, often I've also covered violence, youth violence in Chicago. That's obviously a hot topic right now nationally. And a lot of times I've, you know, we'll talk to high school students, for instance, who tend to be more affected because either they're crime victims, shooting victims, or certainly no victims. But the kids I was talking to are 9 years old and 10 years old and had lived through multiple family members being shot.
Yeah, you have this moment in the piece where you ask a girl whose cousin has been shot, 16-year-old cousin, I think, and ask her if this is the first person she knows who's been shot, and she just looks at you kind of stunned, like, what do you mean? Of course not.
Yeah, and she says, I love what she says to me. She says, no, I remember everything.
Yeah,
and then she starts,
names them.
Yeah, then she starts saying, yeah, when I was 5,
yeah,
you know, this relative, and then when I was 7, this relative, and this little girl, at the time she was 10, had just turned 10.
Yeah.
So I think the depth, and I mean, to me, her words still really haunt me, that one phrase, that one sentence where she says, I remember everything. And to pair that, I believe, with, you know, what we hear and see in the school in terms of the level of counseling or, you know, social work or trauma help that kids are getting, which is non-existent. Not a single kid in the fourth grade qualifies for direct services with a social worker. To pair that reality with the realities I've shown you of hunger and of violence, I think are just very, very hard to reconcile and hard to listen to.
Yeah, very stark. There were, you know, many heartbreaking moments and scenes. And as an education reporter, actually, one of the scenes that I found especially troubling and memorable is actually after the section where you're talking about the fact that back in the late 1960s, Dr. Martin Luther King lived across the street from this elementary school, and it was part of his anti-poverty campaign. He came to live in the neighborhood to experience the poverty firsthand in this neighborhood all the way back in the 1960s. And you tell us about that, and then you take us back to the fourth graders at Penn today, and we're going to play a little bit of that.
For Black History Month, the fourth graders in room 205 learned a poem about King.
Today is the day we all sing in honor of Martin Luther King.
But the fourth graders won't hear that King lived across the street. They won't hear anything about poverty. They won't hear that King said people are poor because wages are low, because discrimination limits opportunities, because schools are underfunded. You're not poor because of you, he told people.
Free at last.
What I find so heartbreaking about that moment in the documentary is what it says about education. And I think as a fellow education reporter, this is one of the harder things to report on, is the quality of what kids are learning in schools. And the fact that those kids in that class are not learning anything about the history of what happened right there in their neighborhood at the moment when they're learning about Black history and Martin Luther King, it seems almost criminal to me, honestly.
Yeah, and I you know, after reporting it and thinking about it, and it was true, you know, this was 2015, and during Black History Month, the posters that were put up around Penn were all about Selma, Alabama. Mm. And, you know, the march across the Pettus Bridge, and victories won in the South. But I don't completely fault Penn for not telling the story of Dr. Martin Luther King in the North and his campaign in Chicago. I think it's a chapter of history that the U.S. has conveniently forgotten, that's really not told in almost any school. I can say, you know, I've was reporting here, living here a bunch of years. And when I initially, you know, if you had asked me what did King do in Chicago, you know, I think the one moment that many Chicagoans remember, and maybe perhaps the nation, maybe the only moment people remember of King in Chicago, is the moment where he's marching on all white neighborhoods in a park called Marquette Park, and a stone hits him and knocks him to his knees. I think that's the sort of emblematic moment from his entire stay here. And I think what people forget, you know, they remember King Stay in Chicago as a housing fight, a fair housing fight, which it certainly became. But King, when he arrived in Chicago in North Lawndale, exactly across the street from William Penn Elementary, he was very clear this was a campaign to end slums. And by slums, you know, I talked to many King historians. They're pretty clear that today that word, you know, which we no longer use, would be translated as a campaign against poverty or a campaign against inequity, income inequality.
Yeah.
But I don't fault Penn alone for that, because I think collectively America has forgotten this chapter of history.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think what stands out to me in terms of that scene in this documentary, it is this larger problem. Like King himself said that to actually deal with slums and poverty, there's a cost to that, and that he rightly predicted and saw that that was one of the hardest things for us to confront. And I guess what's so moving to me is to see these kids in fourth grade who aren't learning about that, understandably, that that is not in their curriculum and something that the school is not doing. But at the same time, in just terms of thinking what we want our schools to do, the fact that these fourth graders are chanting that poem about Martin Luther King and this history happened right there, it just says something larger, I think, maybe about our inability to reconcile all of this. And to then, the question that you ask in this documentary fundamentally is, what are we asking of our schools? What else is undone? You know, what else are we not doing? We are sort of looking away from these schools thinking they're just going to take care of this whole poverty thing. And if they don't, we're just going to label them failing.
Yeah. And, you know, I completely agree. And the question we're really asking, or I'm really posing in the piece is, and, you know, I hope listeners consider this, all listeners, are we wrong about how much we can expect schools to do? You know, what if we're not right? What if school alone is not enough to move people out of poverty, which the evidence certainly suggests it's not. So that's, you know, I think there's dire and deep consequences for children living in poverty and their families, and for the future, really. You know, if we're seeing schools as the principal way to move children and families out of poverty, you know, we know a few things about that. Number one, we have a widening income gap. It is more necessary than ever for children living in poverty to do well in school, because doing well in school is more predictive than ever before of how well you'll do in life, of how likely you are to make a good income and escape poverty. But at the same time, poverty itself has never been more predictive of how well you'll do in school. I mean, it's a horrible catch-22 for poor kids.
We asked listeners for questions they had about this documentary, and I have a few of those that I want to put to you. One question we got was from Mark Sims, and he asks, can you accomplish educational equity within segregated schools?
It's interesting, and speaking about Dr. King as well, here in Chicago, precisely, he, among the demands that the campaign at the time made, well, they wanted the high schools integrated here in Chicago by 1966, and the elementary schools, they'd accept a plan in 1967, but wanted to see integrated elementary schools by September of 1967. So 50 years later, Chicago has some of the most segregated schools in the nation. And I know Mark Sims, so grateful to his question. Regarding economic integration or segregation, I mean, we know that's one of the worst conditions for children to be educated in. I think the work of the Century Foundation, I'm thinking of Richard Kahlenberg, I think the work of Sean Reardon suggests that high poverty schools struggle mightily. And I can think of Sean Reardon's work, for instance, looking at all school districts in the country.
This is Sean Reardon at Stanford, right?
Correct. So Reardon's work has shown that out of thousands of school districts nationwide, we don't have a single school district, high poverty school district, that scores even at average. And, you know, Reardon raises the question in all of the nation, you know, if this were possible, wouldn't we have seen it somewhere? But really, in the entire nation, looking at all school districts, not one scores at average.
That brings up an interesting question, the nitty-gritty of making a documentary like this. But I'm curious about how much sort of other reporting, how much research, how many experts, how much contextual stuff you had to dig through and think about and analyze to create a piece like this, which doesn't include any of that stuff on its face. You know, you don't hear a lot of data and experts. You've really synthesized it and integrated into this narrative.
Right. I tried to make a story that was really a story, and that really for which we never actually leave the fourth grade and room 205 or their neighborhood or their lives. And so everything is told in the context of that classroom of fourth graders and their story over the course of that year. And I'll say, I think the fellowship was hugely beneficial to me. It was a time where I could read a lot, study a lot. So I would say lots and lots of research and discussion with experts went into the my own background knowledge of this piece. You know, one of the things I wanted to answer for myself, because I began to think, you know, so many stories I hear about in the media talk about schools that are beating the odds. And I looked at that a little more closely, and I think I came to the conclusion that we just, as education reporters, we over-report, we vastly over-report from those schools. And I think it gives a false impression of what's possible. You know, clearly, as I say in the piece, it's not impossible. There have always been schools that beat the odds. There will always be children. Everybody knows somebody who came from nothing and has made it. But what we lose sight of is this bigger, broader picture that most kids, the vast majority of kids, are not beating the odds. And I don't feel our country wrestles honestly with that.
We also get several questions from listeners about what you saw with the standardized testing while you were at Penn. So to recap a bit, you were in a staff meeting about a week before the big end-of-the-year standardized tests, and you saw teachers flipping through the actual test booklets, like previewing it. And the principal was there too, endorsing this. And then when the kids actually took the test, you were there again to see that their teacher had let the kids bring these agenda books that they have with them. And those agenda books include reference materials that have things like times tables and decimal charts. And neither of these things is actually allowed, teachers looking at the tests beforehand and kids having these kinds of reference materials during the test. Those things are not supposed to happen. So several listeners wanted to know if the teachers and the principal got in trouble after your piece was broadcast.
I can tell you that some days after the broadcast, the principal was contacted by her supervisor who wanted to discuss those aspects of things. I will still be following up to find out what exactly has happened. They hadn't met the last time I spoke, but she had been contacted. I asked whether she'd been contacted by anyone concerned about the fact that, you know, we had kids who were clearly living through lots of trauma who didn't have access to social workers or any sort of counseling. She had not been contacted about that. She hadn't gotten any offers to pay for an actual music or art teacher. So I promised I would report those things in context.
How did you think about whether and how to include that material? I mean, you obviously include, you know, you get a lot of stuff when you're spending a year at a school. And we can tell by the way you describe it that you wrestled with that a bit. Can you talk a little bit about how you decided what to include?
I can say that I wrestled hugely with that. It took me a very long time to put this piece together, an inordinate amount of time. I really should not have taken that long, but I feel like one of the reasons for that was precisely this: how torn I felt. You know, I felt certainly like an affinity for the teachers and the school I was spending so much time in. I appreciated the school's generosity of opening their doors. They had no obligation to do that. But I'm also a reporter, and this is what I witnessed, and I don't think I could have not reported that.
And I think, as you said very smartly in the story, it's a part of this story. This is a very important part of the story you're telling.
It is a part of the story. I mean, personally, when it happened, the first incident where the teachers are looking at the exams ahead of time, I went home. I think I cried because I said to myself, I just did not want that to be happening.
Yeah, you kind of wished you hadn't seen it. But yet, I think it was an important thing for you to witness also.
It did. It was. And it also helped me understand just I think it underlined for me. I mean, the whole time, from the very first day as I show, the test and testing is a huge part of what's happening at Penn and what the fourth graders are thinking about. And it's really shaping their entire environment, educational environment. And I don't know that I would have put, I think I fairly represented sort of the importance of testing in their class and in their school and in their education. But I'm not sure I would have focused that much on the test myself if I hadn't seen the test security breaches, if we want to call them that.
There's a really nice moment, too, where you see the teacher, their classroom teacher in the hall after you've witnessed that.
This is the first time I've ever put myself in a situation like this. So it makes people wonder, has she been credible for the last 20 years? I know Penn is so close to being closed. And I think I let my emotions get in my way. In this time, space of time, so much is dependent on achievement in terms of whether your school doors stay open, whether people maintain jobs. There's so many things in a school like this that should be in place in terms of helping children to be successful.
I tell Ms. Hathorn, that's the whole point of me being here, to see what Penn is up against, what schools are up against.
Don't nobody care. That's the bottom line, Ms. Leonard. Nobody cares.
At one point in the documentary, you get a chance to talk to former Education Secretary Arne Duncan. He was the Education Secretary when you talked to him. He was in Chicago, which is where he's from. He used to run the Chicago Public Schools. He was in town for this big education research conference. You give us this nice detail, actually, about five hotels full of education experts, essentially, are in Chicago. And you catch up with Duncan, and you ask him, what's the message you would have for the kids at Penn? And he says, basically, work hard, have faith. As tough as it is, you can beat the odds. And then you say really nicely that you're not sure that was a fair question for him. I mean, what would you say to these kids? That's probably what everyone would say to these kids. But my question is, what would you say to the five hotels worth of education experts now that you have done this reporting, the education experts that were a few miles away? What have you learned for them?
I mean, I deeply appreciate their work, as I'm sure you do, but I think much of their work is already pointing us in a direction that we need to sort of wrestle with more. I think a lot of education policy is built around ideology and not evidence. We're very into sort of evidence-based approaches when it comes to methods for teaching math or, curriculum in reading. But when it comes to the very, very big picture, stepping way back and looking at the impact that socioeconomic status has on how well you'll achieve in school, I don't feel we're evidence-based at all on that front.
One last question that we got from a listener, Joanne Olson. She says, I want to ask Linda, what can I, as one person, do to make a difference for these children and their teachers? I can't change the world, and I definitely can't change the socioeconomic climate these children live in, but there must be something I can do.
Well, I'll say that has been the very most common response I've gotten from emails, because I think people do feel touched by the stories that we're broadcasting, and I appreciate that. I guess, I turn somewhat to Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's talked a lot about, in her New York Times Magazine article talks a lot about and has since spoken about individual choices, for instance, about where we live, about where we send our children to school, and how they help either cement racial and class segregation, or they help to tear that down. I think that's one concrete answer. You know, I did put Martin Luther King at the end of the piece again, talking about how to combat poverty. And, you know, he has a lot of ideas in the piece. I'm sure people from other sides of the political spectrum might have other ideas. Again, I think rather than base decisions on ideology, I'd prefer a stance that looked at evidence. But, you know, King brings up the notion that he left Chicago with, which is, in order to fix poverty, we need a direct solution, something more direct than fixing poverty. And he says, through housing or through education, those methods are too indirect. You know, essentially what King advocates for is changes to economic policy. King, in 1966 in Chicago, was advocating for a $2 federal minimum wage. And you translate that in today's terms, and it's just about $15 an hour, which is what people are still fighting for. The childhood poverty rates are actually slightly higher today than they were in 1966. So I think people talk about fighting poverty as a quote-unquote long-term solution. But in reality, I feel like 5 decades is enough time to see that we're not even actually moving in the right direction on this question.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Linda Lutton, an education reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. She was speaking with APM Reports senior correspondent Emily Hanford. A few hours after we recorded that interview, Linda wrote us an email saying she kept thinking about that last listener question, the one about what can one person do to help children like the ones in room 205. And she wanted to add more to her answer. Here's some of what she wrote. She says, "I know many schools find volunteers and tutoring programs helpful, so I'd say sure, get involved. Making a difference one person at a time does matter. But I also think it's important to recognize that our country can change the socioeconomic climate that children live in, and individuals play a role in pushing for that to happen." Linda had even more to say, and we have her full answer on our website, apmreports.org. We'll also post links to some of the research she mentioned in the interview. If you liked The View from Room 205, be sure to check out our recent documentary, What It Takes. It explores many of the same questions about how poverty matters when it comes to education and what schools can and can't do about it. We'll put a link to that on our webpage. We love hearing from you. You can send us a note at contact@apmreports.org or tweet us at Educate Podcast and find us on Facebook too at educate.podcast. Get in touch. Support for APM Reports comes from Lumina Foundation and the Spencer Foundation. I'm Suzanne Pico. Thanks for listening. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.